Good evening and welcome. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm a trustee of this wonderful library, and I'm so happy to welcome you here tonight. And as you know, our library was founded in 1754, the oldest library in the city and one of the oldest in the country. And we've had a terrific series of talks this spring and are so looking forward to Jonathan Galassi tonight. In fact, the moment I woke up this morning, my husband said, "Jonathan's gotten a rave review in the New York Times." So that was a great way to start off the day. And I am hoping you will give generously to the library to support these programs and all our activities. It is a great pleasure to welcome back Jonathan Galassi to the library. And as you all know, Mr. Galassi is the president and publisher of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, one of our most distinguished publishers, and he has published numerous Pulitzer Prize-winning authors. Our library has had an involvement with publishers since the very beginning. Thomas Allen was a publisher and bookseller in New York City between 1789 and 1799, and a New York Society library member who received shares of the library in addition for rebinding books for us. In 1854, Harper and Row asked for our copy of the illustrated Robinson Crusoe, as theirs had been destroyed in a fire. Jonathan and I both became involved in the book world around the same time, in the golden age of bookselling, before the evil empire and the era of discount books and ebooks. His new book, Ode, is a marvelous ode to that wonderful time, as well as being slightly satiric. I adored this book about publishing and tried to figure out how all the characters were. It brought back a happy period of my life at Books and Company, and I was very impressed that the wonderfully intellectual and serious Jonathan Galassi could suddenly write this delectable and amusing and very light first novel. Jonathan is a translator of poetry and a poet himself. He has translated Leopardi and finally made me understand why everybody loves Leopardi so much, and Montali. In addition, he has published 3 collections of poetry, the most recent being Left-Handed Poem. Jonathan has been on the board of the Academy of American Poets for many years and was the board chair after our wonderful Lynn Chase. He is now honorary chairman. And now let us welcome Jonathan Galassi.
Well, I don't really know how to thank Jeanette and Lynn for asking me to come here tonight, but I've been here many times for many different reasons, celebrating our authors, poetry, and it's always been a very special place. It's probably the most beautiful library I've ever been in, and it represents a certain attitude towards writing that I think is very much in key with what I was trying to write about in this book. My book is light, and it's a comedy about the world of book publishing as it used to be. I started in the business in the 70s, early 70s, and the publishers I write about actually were already old-timers and throwbacks then. So this book is a look backward, really, at a whole style of approach to the publishing business that is really ancient history now. It's about the gentleman publishers who were really a phenomenon of the early 20th century, and their names are very famous. Horace Liveright, the first of them, maybe not such a gentleman, but Alfred Knopf, and there was a whole series of small publishing houses that were founded by gentlemen, at least with quotes around them, of means who wanted to do something with their leisure and have fun and do something worthwhile at the same time. And as it happened, I ended up working with the last of these gentlemen publishers and being friends with another of them. And they are the inspiration for the two major figures, publishing figures in the book. The story that I have constructed to evoke this world is of these two men, whom I call Homer Stern and Sterling Wainwright, who absolutely hate each other. They're both rich, they both love writers, and you'd think they'd be the best of friends, but it's just the opposite. This town isn't big enough for both of them. And to make it worse, they're both obsessed with one special writer, the greatest poet of their generation, and her name is Ida Perkins. And Ida is a superstar. She's bigger than any poet has ever been or ever will be. She sells hundreds of thousands of copies. She's a rock star. She's a fashion plate. She is a super heroine. And they both love her. She happens to be the cousin of Sterling Wainwright, who is her longtime publisher. But Homer also covets the honor of being her publisher, and maybe her lover too. She's had a lot of husbands, and she's famously a diva, you know. And so that is the situation of the book. Ida is the focus of their competition, and there's a fourth person in this book, a fourth major character, who's a young man named Paul Dukach, who comes from upstate New York and loves literature. He's been obsessed with Ida himself ever since he was a teenager. He ends up working for Homer, and he's still obsessed with Ida and wants to find a way for her to become part of Purcell and Stern, as the company is called. So that's the setup for the book. And I'm going to read you the first chapter of the book, which is called Homer and Company. And then if we have time, I might tell you a few more things. Homer and Company. Homer is famously vulgar. I'm just warning you. Okay. Fuck the peasants. That ancient cry off the Russian steppe was the trademark toast of Homer Stern, founder, president, and publisher of the Tony impecunious independent publishing house, Purcell and Stern. He raised a glass with it often at dinners celebrating his author's victories, or better yet, defeats, after the numerous award ceremonies that punctuate the publishing year. Homer's salute to his warriors divided the world cleanly into us and them, or maybe it was me and them, a spot-on reflection of his Hun-like worldview. Homer was a womanizer, and he made no particular effort to hide it. It was part of the broad advertisement of self that some found disarming and just as many detested. To his fellows, his frank appreciation of female horseflesh jibed with his loud, nasal, upper-class New York accent and loud, expensive clothes, and his taste for Cuban cigars and Mercedes convertibles. It had taken him years to buy a German car after the war, but his fondness for luxury and display eventually won out over any lingering historical or religious compunctions. Homer exuded a kind of leftover, gently down at the heels, German-Jewish droit de seigneur that was only slightly put on. He'd inherited it from his father, the grandson of a lumber baron who'd made a fortune out west when the first transcontinental railroad needed ties by the boxcar. That was a long time ago, though, and the Stern family coffers were nowhere near as full of dollars as they had been after three generations of dilution without replenishment. As with many who live on inherited wealth, Homer's sense of what money can buy hadn't kept pace with inflation. He was a famously chintzy tipper. Still, he reveled in the bella figura that let him give the impression of being much better off than he was. He once told his son Plato that looking rich made it easier to put off paying his printing bills. His printer of choice, Sonny Lenzner, would always assume he could pay up when he got around to it. As his wife, Iphigenie Abrams, likewise an heiress to a faded Newark department store fortune, was quoted as saying, not without pride, "Homer likes nothing better than walking a tightrope over the abyss." Stern was the last of the independent gentleman publishers, scions of Industrial Revolution fortunes of greater or lesser magnitude, who decided to spend what remained of their inheritance on something that was fun for them and perhaps generally worthwhile. College right after the war, he'd attended a series of institutions of descending degrees of seriousness, always managing to get himself thrown out before graduation, was followed by a stint in the Army's public relations branch, where he'd done his damnedest to sell enlistment via jingle and poster to a conflict-weary public. He'd also acquired a penchant for inventive profanity, which, combined with the Yiddishisms he'd picked up later on when he and Iphigenie got interested in their Jewish roots, made for a delicious idiomatic goulash all his own. When Homer set out in the dark days of the 50s to start a publishing house with Hayden Vanderpool, a wealthy WASP tennis buddy of his, he'd invited Frank Purcell. Like the composer, he invariably said on being introduced, in case someone might mistakenly put the accent on the second syllable. Frank was a once celebrated editor from an older generation who'd been unceremoniously cut loose from his previous job while he was off in Korea. In the end, Vanderpool's mother had objected to linking his impeccable name with the Jews, and Hayden hadn't wanted to work 9 to 5 anyway, so it was just Homer and Frank, Stern and Purcell, or Purcell and Stern, as Frank had insisted, reasonably enough. They set up shop and waited for something to happen. Eventually, something had. The fledgling company struggled along for a while on the occasional commercial bestseller, nutrition Bibles, and the collected speeches of various governors and secretaries of state. Remember, this was the 50s, with now and then a high-toned foreign novel recommended by one or another of Homer's European scouts, pals from his army days, now working some muttered sotto voce as undercover operatives for the CIA. It wasn't until the mid-60s, though, that Homer convinced Georges Savoie, a French émigré with a genuine feeling for writing and a well-stocked stable acquired during a productive but turbulent career at Owl House, to come work with him and Frank, that Purcell and Stern gelled. Soon enough, through the alchemical fusion of Georges' taste and connections with Homer's salesmanship, not to mention the contributions of a series of young staffers who slaved 12 or 14 hours a day at abysmal wages for the privilege of being associated with greatness, PNS emerged as a force to contend with in literary publishing, a kind of rocket of originality. PNS, surprisingly quickly, became a legend in publishing circles, And that was where the trouble between Homer and Sterling Wainwright began. PNS came to be regarded as the smallest, scrappiest, and most literary of the major publishers, while Wainwright's impetus editions, for all its cultural impact and influence, Sterling had had half a decade's head start on Homer, to be fair, was considered the largest and most esteemed of the small presses, another world altogether. And though Homer was stingy with author advances, Impetus was cheaper still, much, much cheaper. Even so, there was significant overlap, and when the cocky young Jewish-American author Byron Hummock left Impetus for PNS after the publication of his prize-winning book of stories, All Around Sheboygan, war was declared, and it had never ended. Wainwright, a card-carrying wasp from Ohio whose inheritance, ball bearings, trumped Stearns by a factor of 10, some said much more, regarded Homer as a crass and ill-mannered upstart opportunist, not a man of his word, a time-honored defense for someone who's been bested in the rough and tumble of business. Homer derided Sterling as a playboy, indulging his literary pretensions without any practical acumen or publishing savvy, which was kind of rich when you thought about it, given Homer's own background. No, the trouble was not what separated Sterling and Homer. It was how alike they were. Both were spoiled, handsome, charming ladies' men with a nose for writers. You might have thought they'd be natural pals, but you'd have been dead wrong. They cordially detested each other and greatly enjoyed doing so. Something else Sterling and Homer shared was an obsession with the poetry and person of Ida Perkins, arguably the representative American poet of their era. To each of them, she was the embodiment of writerly, not to mention feminine, desirability. Sterling, of course, adored, revered, and published his cousin Ida, but Homer had his own attachment to her. The rumor which he was capable of putting about himself was that they had shared their own moment in time, as he liked to call his affairs. Nobody knew for sure. You've heard that, haven't you? Nobody knew for sure, but the frequency and tenderness of Homer's allusions to Ida were an index of something for those with ears to hear. Ida, as both an attention-grabbing literary star and an alluring female, was a kind of holy grail for him, not dissimilar to, though if anything more fetishized and coveted than, Hart, Schaffner, and Marx, as he called the leading Jewish-American novelists of the late 60s, Abe Burak, Byron Hummock, and Jonathan Targoff, of whom he never managed to capture more than two at any one time, try as he might. Authors were to Homer what paintings or real estate or jewelry were to his richer relations, living, breathing collectibles, outward and visible signs of his inward and spiritual substance. To publish Ida would, in some sense, be the capstone of his career, more even than Pepita Erskine, or the Three Aces, or Hart, Schaffner, and Marx, because he already owned or had owned all of them at one point or another, even if some had eventually managed to pry themselves loose. But Ida was the one he hadn't managed to bag, as he graciously put it. She belonged to his gnat of a rival, Sterling Wainwright, who was related to her after all, and for Homer too, blood mattered. There was simply nothing he could do about it, not that he hadn't made one frontal assault after another, only to be genteelly put off time and again. No, Ida was Homer's bird in the bush, and it rankled like an unscratched itch. Fucking Ida Perkins gets all the headlines and wins all the prizes, and what do we get? Bupkis, he'd grumble, as if it was their fault to Georges Savoie and anyone else he could buttonhole on his editorial staff. A raggle-taggle gatherum of talented misfits, many of whom he'd scooped up on the beach, always at a considerable discount after they'd been let go by more hard-nosed mainstream houses, starting with Frank and George. Each had succumbed to Homer's spell in one way or another. Portly Patty Femer, an exceptionally gifted editor whose perfectionism made it nearly impossible for him to let go of the manuscripts he noodled over, sometimes for years. Cadaverous Elsa Pogorski, known around the office as Morticia, invariably dressed in black from head to toe and forever scowling through forbidding black glasses, one of Homer's nuns of publishing, who sat resentfully at her desk all day correcting the numberless translations of unsaleable story writers and poets from the other Europe that Abe Burek and others were constantly pressing on Homer. Crotchety, heart of gold copy chief Esperanza Esparza, renowned for her way with a red pencil, who seemed never to leave her desk, surrounded by its array of scraggly avocado and spider plants that leached all the available light from her grimy office window. Homer's team was united in subservient loyalty to their larger-than-life leader, whose paternal insouciance made them feel sundown for once in their lives, essential players in an enterprise of unquestionable significance. His allegro benevolence was like catnip. Why, it was nearly as good as money. So they beavered away while he sat back with his feet on his desk like an overdressed Tom Sawyer, smiling his toothy smile and entertaining himself placing troublemaking calls to agents and journalists. Who do I have to blow to get Burek's new book reviewed, baby? He'd jaw to his sidekick, Florian Brundage, affectionately known as Chowderhead, the Daily Blade's chief book critic and, perhaps not entirely incidentally, a PNS novelist, picking his teeth all the while. Your piece on that cow, I'm too refined to mention Hortense Houlihan. To tell the truth, Homer made use of a coarser, unprintable epithet, was shit, and you know it. Miraculously, books emerged from PNS's Augean stables. Usually they won kudos. Often they won prizes. And now and again they sold reasonably well. Sometimes working for Homer was peaches and cream. Occasionally it was infuriating, but mostly it was kind of fun. All you had to do was accept that it was Homer's shop, 100%. There were no office politics at PNS because he decided everything. So people, those who lasted, relaxed and homed in on their work, endlessly complaining about the peremptory, ungrateful, self-involved authors whose writing they idolized. They were utterly mad, of course, but they did their level best to ignore one another's foibles since they were the same as their own. And to many of them, the cramped, filthy offices on Union Square were a mind-bending, topsy-turvy little heaven on earth. So that's the world of Muse. And many things happen in the book. But I thought I would close my little presentation by moving ahead to the later part of the book where Paul, the ingenue editor, by hook and by crook, gets himself invited to go visit Ida Perkins, who by this point is an old lady living in Venice, and she has been living there with another writer who died, and she's stayed on there alone, and she is a shut-in, basically. And after Paul's visit to her, she gives him something, which is her last manuscript. And this manuscript has many consequences for everyone in the book, and the plot turns on the manuscript. But I thought I'd just read you a few of the poems in the manuscript, which are in the book. they're poems of memory about a love affair, and the tone is very different. The tone darkens in the book. It's not just a comedy. It becomes something else. But I thought I'd just read you two or three of them to give you a sense of another aspect of the book. The book is called Mnemosyne, or in Greek they say Mnemosyne, but for the purpose of rhythm, I've called it Mnemosyne. And Mnemosyne was the Titaness, the mother of the muses and the goddess of memory. And the book is about memory. It's about remembering another time. It's about remembered love. And so I'll read you three poems from this manuscript, which turns out to be epic making for these characters. This is called Mnemosyne Remembers. Mnemosyne remembers, it's her job. The stationary heat, the glare, the trance, the listless lob, then evening coming on, coolth, cardigan on ramrod's shoulders, sharp myopic stare across the meadow where the great man's sheep browse as in an underwater dream. No stars, the tipsy stumble down the hill in utter darkness. Then the age-old dance, hand held and no stitch dropped, but one word said. Mnemosyne was there. The only thing she does is this, recall. It's what she does. It's who she is. That's all. So this is Ida. This is Ida remembering. Ida, who's been the sex goddess, the superstar, at all. She's an old woman, she's alone, she's bereft, she's remembering. I waited in the sunlight by the water, waited in the breeze to hear the rustle in the parted grass, to see the towel fall on the chair, the body sink beside me and unfold, the silver voice remind me I was there. I might have dozed, but I don't think I did. I was so dazed with waiting, I got lost in time without you, time I have no way of clawing back, stale time that swivels counterclockwise down the drain, time that crystallizes pain, time that isn't life or air, foul time that doesn't move, but disappears. I waited in the sun all afternoon. I waited on the dock till it was cold. And when I raised my head up, I was old. And here's the last one. The book ends with this poem, Goldenrod. Mnemosyne remembers as she sits and stares across the water every day. Hard as she tries, she finds there's no reprise. Far too much evades her failing eyes. But always she sees hair and forehead, lips meeting lips and skin on ageless skin. She summons its faint mineral scent and knows what she remembers isn't sin. And though she can't have back each gone embrace, each breath, each hopeless kiss, she knows she does own this. The last time that she watched you turn to trace your footsteps through the goldenrod, she remembers that she heard you call, miss you, darling, see you in the fall. Mnemosyne remembers that was all. So now people are going to make comments. Ask, yes.
I know your work mainly through your the relations he had, which are so much a part of his poetry with these different women who were like muses to him, it's so startling to me that now in this work you've created a woman who's the poet and who almost is assuming his place. Did any of that work?
I definitely... You're the only person who has made me think about that, actually. But he has to be in there because he's so deeply ingrained in everything I have done in writing. And the book, the central moment in the book takes place in Venice, which was a very important part of a place for him. And yes, there's a lot of, how would I say, hidden romance in the book that relates to his own story in a very indirect way, a transposed way. But yes, there's definitely something of that in it. Thank you. Thank you for letting me see that. Gail. I'm working on another novel. It's totally different from this. I really loved writing prose. I had so much fun writing this book. This new book is not fun, but it's. I got the bug of the creation, trying to create characters, and it's true that Roger Strauss inspired Homer Stern. Absolutely, I'm not even going to pretend to deny that. But I hope Homer Stern becomes Homer Stern somehow in the process.
But do you think Roger would approve of this book? That's my question.
Well, let's just say that I showed it to Roger Strauss III before I published it, and he had no objection. So whether Roger Strauss Jr. would have had an objection, depends what day it would have been, I think. I used to work with this person.
But what about Ida? Is she based on composite or what?
Ida is totally made up. But as this lady has said, she represents she's the muse, and Montale had a muse, and so did Leopardi, and many. So it's the, how would I say, the impersonation of this idealized person who has always been at the core of what these writers worked at. So she's not real. She's an idea. And a very smart friend of mine, when she read the book, said, "Well, Ida is literature. She represents this ideal for these publishers. What is the thing that they idealize most? It's literature." So I think she's probably that in some way. Joni.
Just to follow up, when I read the book, what I just thought was amazing was that you actually wrote poems that I wrote. And I thought that was really brave. And I also wondered, when you were working on it, did you know all along that you would write poems that I wrote?
I really, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know what I started out knowing. The way I wrote this book is, one summer, I decided I would try to write fiction. I had never done it. And so what I did, someone had told me this once, and I took the advice. Every day I wrote for several hours. I never looked at it. I never went back to it. And I did that for a month. And then I put it all away for a year. And then I looked at it a year later and decided I could do something with it. And I don't remember. I started out with these scenes that were partly drawn from my own experience, and I had some great characters to work with, but then something started to take off and take over, but I don't remember when I decided, but I was doing this for fun, and I wanted to try to write the poems of this person. It was risky, but, and you know, she's supposed to be the greatest poet of her generation. You know, you can't do that, or I can't, but I can pretend. It's part of the joke of the book. So,
given what you've seen and whom you've known, were the days of Strauss and James Laughlin, were those really the good old days?
Well, you know, there was I remember when I was at Random House, Bob Loomis published a book called The Good Old Days, They Were Terrible. You know, it's a famous book from the Bettman Archive, I think. And, you know, part of the book is about how we make things, we create images of things. They were wonderful because I was young. And you know, and it was fun, it really was such fun. But the kids who are working at FSG today are probably, I hope they're having fun, and they don't know about this, so they can't miss it. So, Susanna, is it different?
Oh, God.
Yes, yes, Roger.
So, not having read your book yet, it does, what you said does make me think of Alvin Hollinghurst's book, A Stranger's Child, which is about a poet who is considered a prodigy and then reassessed over 100 years of people trying to understand him better. Does your book end with Ida alive and still in her on her throne, or does it include people reassessing her from a different generational perspective?
The book goes from the past into the future. Ida is dead, and the book ends with her bibliography. So it's still, yes, and the bibliography goes through 2020, and there are critical works about her in the bibliography. So. Yes. Well, that is. That's the secret of the book that I can't tell you. If you read the book, you'll know the answer. No, I'm serious. It's a surprising answer, I hope.
Thanks so much.